Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Neville Pearce, a journalist and filmmaker whose short films include Bricks, Lock-In, and Ghosted. His latest, Promise, just went live on Vimeo last month. It recontextualizes a biblical tale from modern-day Britain, which is where we recorded this episode. So that worked out nicely. Nev picked Seven, David Fincher's game-changing 1995 thriller starring Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt as newly partnered homicide detectives on the trail of a particularly insidious serial killer, one who's very well acquainted with the seven deadly sins and who seems determined to lead them down the darkest path imaginable in the service of his mission. It's one of the defining films of the 90s, inspiring dozens of imitations that were all made by people who thought that Andrew Kevin Walker's script was just a gimmick. But that's not what people responded to in Seven. That's not it at all. This is someone else's movie.
Seven has had a profound effect on me, I think. You know, I saw it when I was 18. I was looking back at when I must have seen it. It would have been January 96, because those are the days when there was a bit of a gap between the UK and the US.
Yeah, yeah.
So it would have been a damp day in Bournemouth, and I went along with some friends, probably when we should have been studying. And I just remember, I think I went along because I think I knew Fincher had directed it, and I really liked Alien 3, which was sort of a counter view at the time. In fact, I think I'd certainly like it more than he does.
I think most people like it more than he does at this point. It's come back around.
And so I knew that, and I knew that Brad Pitt was in it, and Brad Pitt was, I'd seen Legends of the Fall, and, you know, hit California, and everyone was trying to make him a movie star, and I was like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
So being a contrarian, I thought, well, let's go and see. You know, can it, you know, is it really worth all the rave reviews? And I was just blown away by it, just completely floored by it. I remember leaving and just turning to my friend and saying, I feel like I want to shoot someone. And knowing that that was like a weird reaction to have to a film, and feeling really deeply unsettled by it. But I love that. I love that when you watch a movie. It doesn't have to be a violent film or an upsetting movie even, but like a movie which changes the way you view the world just slightly, even like for the few minutes after you walk out, like everything seems like fresh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the sky and that's a car. And, you know, and I think it just really, it affected me probably in ways I didn't really recognise and only kind of recognise now in terms of the nature of the story. Yeah, okay, it's a cop film and it's a serial killer film, but it's, I like the two main characters and their kind of battle between idealism and experience, and apathy and, you know, trying to get stuff done. I think that's a battle that we all face.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really compelling. Obviously, within this incredible thriller and incredible kind of high concept/exploitation film, you know, The Seven Deadly Sins being such a, like, oh, this is going to be lurid.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I was trying to figure out a way to describe the impact of the film. It wasn't that no one had made that sort of film before. Clive Barker was making them then. But there was some strange alchemy in the way that Seven came together, right? Like the aestheticized imagery is one thing, and then the fact that you never see the murders, that we're always stumbling upon them. There's a sense that something... And it tips into full horror a number of times. I mean, not just because of the tableau that we see, but because of the way that it slowly, you know, reveals its endgame, which is the crisis of faith that is taking place, not just in one detective's soul, which is the easy way of explaining it. I mean, like, that's the same thing you can define someone saying, oh, The Dark Knight is really about the struggle for Batman's soul. It's like, no, it's about the Joker turning Harvey Dent into a monster. That's the thing everybody misses. The Joker wins that movie.
Yeah.
And John Doe wins in Seven, spoilers, because ultimately the movie is making it possible for the world to allow him to win. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, by the time we get there, the film has gone from this rain-soaked noir pastiche to this blazing desert confrontation where there is nothing but suffering and the world has been bleached of all hope, and to get there in 127 minutes and to have Fincher so confidently steer that tone, right? Because Andrew Kevin Walker's script supposedly went through a number of different versions and different variations, and the ending isn't always the ending, and they were back and forth right up to the end on how Somerset was going to play the final sequences. I'm jumping all over, but it's a remarkable piece of craft that is, yeah, incredibly disturbing in the way that it attenuates its tone and gets us to the place that it takes us. Because we're riding along with them by the time we get there. It's the comedy sort of falls away, the mission takes over, and I remember I was older in '95. I would have been in my late 20s, and it was really I wasn't agitated the same way. I wasn't activated by the film, but it was incredible to realize that it was going to go to this place that these movies aren't supposed to go to. You know, detective thrillers are supposed to end with weary resignation, and it does, but not because they've seen the devil. It's really something that there's an almost supernatural undercurrent to the film that you're supposed to be thankful at the end when the bad guy is revealed and his plan is just a crazy person's plan. But no, this like the evil keeps going. The depths of it keep revealing themselves. And that was really, really jarring. But being 18 and being, you know, when you're still figuring out what your aesthetic is and what appeals to you, that would have been like being hit in the face with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of my notes, is it was like being hit with a sledgehammer. And I think it's one of the reasons it works. You're trying to touch on why it works, because it's not, you know, not the only film, obviously, within that kind of space. Mm-hmm. But I think it's sincere. Like, I don't think it's setting out to be sensational. I mean, it is sensational, and it is, you know, Andrew Kevin Walker was writing for an exploitation horror house at the time, you know, company when he came up with Seven. So it's like, comes from that kind of mindset to a degree. But I don't think it's a movie that's setting out to shock you. I mean, it does shock you. But I think it's because it's Somerset's movie, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a two-hander, but ultimately it's his journey. And it's him. You know, my favourite book in... this might seem like a bit of a left turn, but my favourite book in the Bible is Ecclesiastes. Because that book is kind of more or less going, yeah, you know what? Things are a bit shit, aren't they? But you just got to press on anyway.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like the recognition of the fact that, yeah, there's plenty of grim, miserable things in the world, and you have to face them and you have to press on anyway. And I feel like that's what this film does, you know. And I just, you know, the scene that I love the most in the whole thing is probably Mills and Somerset in the bar, when they kind of basically do, you know, articulate their points of view on the way the world is. And you agree with both of them. And that's... There's that, and then at the end when they're in the car driving John Doe out to the desert, and the three of them, I mean, Somerset isn't really saying very much, but Mills is spouting off and John Doe is full of righteous indignation, and you're like, you're a terrible, terrible human being, and you also have a point. This is confusing.
Yeah.
You know, that, I think that's one of the reasons it works so well, is, you know, one of the things I think Fincher talks about is, in the scenes, he wants everyone's point of view to be valid, you know, for everyone to be making a compelling case, rather than it very obviously being, well, that guy's completely wrong.
Yeah.
And the risk of that is you end up kind of having people watch Fight Club and going away thinking Tyler Durden is actually a hero, as opposed to a sort of dangerous figure with somebody's imagination. But that's one of the reasons those films are powerful. Again, it's like it's not just holding your hand the whole way through and telling you how to think.
Yeah. Gene Grey and I talked about that on the Fight Club episode. I think now I'm beginning to think that Fincher's the director we've covered the most in this podcast. Like, we've done, this makes all three of his 90s films are covered. And the thing about Fight Club is, yeah, if you think Tyler Durden is the good guy an hour in, that means the film is working, because we are being seduced. Or we are, from the narrator's perspective, we are understanding why he appeals to people. If you still think he's the good guy at the end of the movie, you have not understood the movie. And Seven, yeah, he's sort of testing the waters there for what indulgences he can ask from an audience. And I think the most disturbing thing about Seven at the time was that John Doe is allowed to explain himself at length, as opposed to every other thriller, which, you know, the killer says three things in a quick, you know, overheated delivery when he's exposed. You don't understand. It all has to go down. Capitalism. And then he gets shot or he's arrested. And here there's another act. He reveals himself. It's unnerving. And then act four. You know, like, what happens now? And now the most disturbing thing, of course, is that it's Kevin Spacey who has become an unperson thanks to revelations of him being a bitch hit. I mean, I'm underplaying that. He's done apparently terrible things, and I believe the people who say those things about him. So it was a little difficult to get back into the film this time. It's just, you know, that we haven't figured this out as a culture yet, when it's okay to understand that a work can still exist without being tainted by the participation of the people involved in it at the time. It's, I don't know, it's a whole thing, obviously, that we're all wrestling with, and I haven't figured it out for myself yet. But the thing that annoys me the most about watching Seven now is that Spacey's so good. Like, he's really good, and it makes it even worse to know that he's not a good person and that he's hurt people. Because, god damn it, and he's tainted all of the stuff that he was fantastic in. Like, this and The Usual Suspects and American Beauty, and they're great performances that now have to have an asterisk surrounding them. And I'm not asking you to comment on that necessarily, but when was the last time you watched the film? I mean,
this morning.
Really? Okay, so
yeah, with the commentary on, though, rather than... And I saw the film without the commentary about 2 months ago. Hmm. 2 or 3 months ago.
So still post-Revelations.
Yeah, I mean, I maybe... I don't know what this says about me. I don't particularly have a problem with it in terms of that sense of, like, an asterisk beside people, because I kind of feel like the work is the work. And you hear... I hadn't heard any of those stories about him prior to them coming out, but you do hear stories about people, not necessarily of that nature, but of other behaviour. And you think, you know, I can think of filmmakers who I'm like, well, I could admire their work and not want to hang out with them.
Yeah, it's certainly always been... I mean, Polanski comes to mind, yeah. Right? Things like that.
I mean, Polanski, I think... I mean, this is slightly off topic, but, like, the Polanski thing is... You know, he was... I've read those statements. The statements were given to the police at the time, and he was done, and he should have been in prison, and he should be in prison now. So...
Yeah, everyone forgets the whole convicted part. Yeah. Like, he went to trial and was convicted.
So I feel like a lot of people get lumped, put in one pot, and I think there is a distinction there. You know, he should have gone to jail. That said, you know, yeah, he should have gone to jail. Yeah, I still think Chinatown's a brilliant movie.
Right. It's hard to argue against the quality. That's the frustrating problem when someone does tremendous work and is also a monster. It's distracting now. I mean, yeah. I haven't come around to it yet. I haven't figured out a way to get to it yet, because, unfortunately, I really want to watch The Usual Suspects again, and I remember Bryan Singer, another person who is now becoming difficult to talk about, in 2000, I think, saying that the reason he had to cast Spacey in The Usual Suspects is because you had to believe in the end that that guy was a monster, and that he could play that, and that's just a thought that gets... creepier and worse now. But that was the same, and to get back to Seven, those films were released 2 months apart in the US. The Usual Suspects opened at the end of August and Seven in early October. And that was just a stunning display of range from that one guy. And in both cases, he was working with directors who knew precisely how to use him and get the most out of those performances, and surrounded by actors who were at least capable of standing up to him, if not more so. And so the reveal of him in Seven, as, you know, we glimpse the photographer, who is also him in a hat, but the reveal of him at the end of the second act or third act, depending on where you are in your structure classes, is genuinely shocking and undercut for me only because some idiot handed me the press notes on the way into the press screening, and it said right on the front page, "And Kevin Spacey as John Doe," which we should not have seen before the movies, before That's the film painful. Started. So I'm just waiting for him.
Yeah.
But you, I assume...
No idea, because he insisted on being uncredited, didn't he? Yeah, actually, in terms of, you know, the advertising.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's credit to Brad Pitt that he's in the film, that Spacey was John Doe, because Fincher wanted Spacey, and then they wouldn't, the studio wouldn't meet his price. And so they looked at Ali Ermey to play that. Obviously, he ended up playing the police captain.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Brown auditioned for it. It was, you know, from With
That. Danny from With That. That would have been a very different performance. Oh, and of course, he's in Alien 3, right?
Yeah. Ned Beatty was sent it, and then, like, told Fincher that he thought it was evil. And then Pitt asked, you know, who's going to play John Doe, and Fincher explained, well, I'd like Spacey, but the studio went spring for it, so Pitt phoned the studio and got them to spring for Spacey.
God. Every step of the way, that movie could have been something less.
Well, it's astonishing when you think about the fact the first draft that Fincher got was the first draft, but it was sent it by mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I know the story, but please.
Yeah, and the same with Pitt, I think. I don't know whether he got it by mistake, but certainly it was Pitt and Fincher and Morgan Freeman insisting in the face of, I think, certainly antipathy from Arnold Copperson, the producer, like the idea that, you know, and it was like 2 weeks out from production before they finally got it agreed that it would be the Head in the Box movie.
Yeah.
And the way that they got it to be the Head in the Box movie was by telling the producer, like, this is the Head in the Box movie. Everyone's going to remember it's the Head in the Box movie. Don't take the Head in the Box out of the Head in the Box movie.
Yeah. You can make this film and it will be a mild hit, or 20 years from now, somebody at a party is going to be talking about the movie with the Head in the Box that he saw on television the night before. And that, of course, assumes that people will still be watching television, which is, like, that's not how we consume film anymore 20 years, 30 years later. But, no, 20. But it is, it's, yeah, it's a film that people had to fight for. And now, in the rearview mirror, there's no other way that movie could exist. It has to go there. It has to be this. The thing that haunts me about that ending, too, isn't just the Head in the Box, but knowing that the dogs are dead, like, that he had to kill them to get to her, and that moment on second, it didn't hit me the first time, but the second time I saw it, I mean, you get the scene where Mills plays with the kids, which is just such a great unexpected character beat, too, that's how they talk about them, and they're both exhausted, and yeah, two golden retrievers, you would be exhausted, but then the second time through, it's just like, oh, fuck, the dogs are gone. Like, he's going to come home and there's nothing.
I think that was one of the ideas for the alternate ending, is somebody suggested that the dogs, the head of the dogs being in the box.
Mm-hmm. Which any dog owner will tell you, absolutely, kill the motherfucker. Yeah. But, but yeah, it doesn't hit the same way. And it would be, you risk, obviously, just looking silly. But especially if you only see one. What would you show, one ear or something sticking out? Like, you can't.
A snout.
Yeah. But again, and if it wasn't Paltrow who was just luminous at that point in her career, she'd only made two or three films, but she was the thing to watch in all of them, and she has one scene in Malice the year before, and it's the best scene in the movie. And Pitt and Paltrow together are just, like, their chemistry is real. Obviously
they fell in love making the movie.
Yeah. But that's never supposed to show, right? Like, all those stories about people falling for each other, working on film, when you watch the movie, there's no chemistry. It's the weirdest thing, because they're trying to hide it. And this one is just two radiant, perfect, tall, blonde people. I mean, it's the American dream, which is why she has to die, because that's the whole point of the film. But everything about it, if it had been someone else, if it had been a different actor or a different actress, it would just, I don't know that it would land the same way. It's such a strange concoction.
Yeah, I don't know who was considered, if there were, who was considered instead of Paltrow, if anyone was. I mean, originally Denzel Washington was going to play Mills.
Yeah, I knew Pitt wasn't the first one.
I mean, prior to Fincher being involved. And at that point, Fincher met with Gene Hackman to play Somerset.
Mm. That could have been interesting.
Yeah, but apparently Hackman said, this reads like a lot of this is shot at night. I don't do night shoots. So Fincher's like, okay, thanks for your time. You know, that's that.
That's amazing.
And it was Arnold Copperson who got the script of Freeman, because they'd made Outbreak together.
Mm.
And I think everyone thought, or certainly Fincher thought, I was going to be too kind of, you can't give this to Morgan Freeman. but he said yes, and then they went to Pitt. And I think that's another example of great casting with Pitt, because yes, obviously he was hot, you know, beautiful, green light movies, but he still had a lot to prove as an actor. And I think you see that in his performance, and I mean that in a good way. Like, you put him up against Morgan Freeman, that I'm sure Brad Pitt, the man, is feeling like he has something to prove in a way that's super useful for, you know,
for Mills. Yeah.
It's like, and that's why the performance is very showy. Like, he's doing a lot of stuff and Freeman's just kind of sat there. And that just works brilliantly. I don't know if that was, well, I presume it was intentional.
Yeah. I think Pitt probably still is just intuitive enough an actor to know that that will work. I mean, the Marquis de Chardin joke, which apparently was one of his line readings, is... like, it says everything about that character, that he's not there yet. Like, he's still trying too hard to impress this reference that he thinks, you know, like, he thinks he knows how to pronounce it, but it got a huge laugh. Like, he got a huge laugh at a press screening in a small room with 30 people. That doesn't happen. We are very quiet people, as you know.
Yeah.
But it was one of those moments where it's just like, oh, this is... like, this movie knows what it's doing in the depiction of the relationship. And I think he hadn't shot 12 Monkeys yet.
No, I think 12 Monkeys was after that.
It was released just a couple of months later, but I think they were shot a year apart. Mm. And again, that, like, knowing that that performance is in his pocket as well, and that in that fall that he made those two movies, it's just where those two films opened against each other, basically. And it is just amazing to see the spread in those performances, the range that he shows.
He's a really interesting example, I think, of someone who gets better and better, and you see him learning on screen.
Mm.
And I interviewed him once when I tried to get him talking about his performances, and rarely for an actor he didn't like talking about himself.
Yeah, he doesn't.
It was like, okay, I figured out, like, way too late into the interview, it's like, if I talk to you about the world, you know, journalism, things like that, you'll be interested, but talking about yourself, you don't really care.
Yeah, he's always shied away from, I've never interviewed him myself, but he's always shied away from process or anything about, like, what draws him to projects, unless there's a specific, I think he'll talk about politics as a line towards something. Like, he said Mr. and Mrs. Smith was his attack on capitalism after Fight Club, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he's got something to prove as an actor. It's 1994 when they shoot it, and he's made A River Runs Through It and Legends of the Fall and obviously Thelma and Louise, but he's still the pretty boy, or the pretty boy who's trying not to be the pretty boy by growing the big beard in Legends of the Fall and being all serious. And then this comes along and he doesn't seem to have a lot of protection, right? Like, there's no tricks he can pull. He doesn't have the contact lens in 12 Monkeys. He doesn't have the period stuff going on for him from the other films. It's just him in a suit. And it's one of his, I think it really is one of his best performances, because there's nothing between him and the other actors.
Because the stuff he did pre-Thelma and Louise, this is my thing about this, slightly off point, but about just kind of learning. Now we see it with actors and we see it with filmmakers. We expect people to be brilliant right out the gate. You know, you see it with directors where they make a film and you go, yeah, that's all right, 3 stars, you won't get to make another one. And you see it with actors as well, there's a massive pressure on people to be brilliant immediately. And sometimes people, you know, in, like, recent examples, like Ryan Reynolds and Jake Gyllenhaal, who people could see something in them, so they kept on getting given a shot, and eventually it did work.
Yeah.
But Pitt was the same. Like, the stuff he did in the 80s, pre-Thelma and Louise, he was the lead in movies. And
I was reviewing video at the time, I saw him.
Oh, dear.
Johnny Suede is interesting. Yeah. That's the best one of those.
Yeah.
There was that, was it called Cutting Class? The one where...
And is it Across the Line?
Running... I think Across the Line, maybe.
Oh, I should probably.
But yeah, the teen rebel stuff, that just because he looked like that.
And my point is not to be sort of bad-mouthing his early work, but just to be like, you know, it's kind of encouraging. You know, to see someone who started out, you watch those movies and you'd be like, okay, you're here because you're pretty, but why on earth else are you here?
Yeah.
And then he just kind of evolved. And I think he's a really good producer now as well, at least in terms of his instincts for material and the things he goes after.
Oh yeah, Plan B is making some great stuff.
You know, I think weirdly he's not necessarily appreciated enough, because he's still very pretty and very famous and, you know, a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
But how gifted he is. And yeah, that's definitely the film which, like, stands out for me, as the one where you're like, oh, okay, you've got it. Like, and I guess it's not an accident that he's somebody who, you know, won the Fincher 3 times now. Which is really the only repeat business that Fincher's done with a lead, you know. And you're right, there's nothing there between him and the audience, in a way that there is, like, 12 Monkeys, like, it's a good performance, but it's
It's a performance. Yeah, exactly.
He's I probably haven't seen that since it came out.
I just rewatched it a couple months ago, as it turns out, and it is, he is a pinball. He is just bouncing literally off of the other actors. And it's delightful, but it's also a huge misdirect because of the way the structure of the film works. And so it's very entertaining, but he ultimately has no purpose. You could lift him out of the movie, and the movie would still, like, the events, that's the whole point, the events would unfold anyway. Mm-hmm. But it's delightful and weird, and he didn't do the junket, which was, I was on that press junket in New York because I wanted to meet Terry Gilliam, mm-hmm. and everything else was just a bonus. But he wasn't there, and it was really disappointing because there are so many questions about influence, about, you know, why, and now, of course, 20-odd years later, I know he wouldn't have answered any of them. But it's a fascinating thing to be watching that career in the rearview mirror now and looking back. It's like Morgan Freeman has been playing world-weary people before Seven and since Seven.
Yeah.
And Brad Pitt rarely plays ordinary human beings. It's just not something that people see him as, and with good reason. But, yeah, Mills is a phenomenal character for him. He has this fully developed arc. He's descending into the circles of hell with no way out, and he doesn't know it, which makes it absolutely tragic the second and third and fourth time through to follow his disintegration.
Well, he's the guy who's like the audience is running. It's like he's the pup who's going to get kicked in the face. Yeah. He's running headlong into the wall, kind of going, yeah, we can do this. Yeah. Oh dear.
Yeah. And his conviction matched to Somerset's cynicism is, I think, where the push-pull, where it's what allows all the philosophy to work. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, they both have valid points, but we want to believe him mm-hmm. because he's the optimist. Mm-hmm. And that's why the movie works. Like, that's why the movie comes down on you at the end the way it does, just because, oh, no, you don't know what you're in for at all, and nothing in your world. It's not, you know, there's always the line in these movies where nothing we've ever seen, nothing can prepare you, but nothing in his perspective can prepare him. Mm-hmm. He's coming at something that is literally inconceivable to him, and Somerset sees it before he does.
And Somerset says it the whole way through the movie, and I think that's another reason why the end works versus some kind of twist ending mm-hmm. movies. Is that, yeah, it's certainly a surprise, you know, and I mean, I couldn't say how many times I've seen it. I still find the film hugely satisfying. Obviously nothing is going to quite equal the first time you sure. see it and go, what? You know, just you just feel hollowed out. But the movie warns you the whole way through. You know, Somerset saying this is not going to end well, you know. It might be a subtitle underneath, you know, on the screen throughout. But by which you mean that when it is a very downbeat ending, to say the least, you're like, it's not. I think that's probably one of the reasons why people, it got good word of mouth and people did go back to it. It writes a check and then it cashes a check.
Yeah.
It's not just doing something completely out of the blue. And the best movies that have those kind of twists do that. Like Sixth Sense is another one of those where you go, you watch it a second time around and you go, how did I not notice that? I realised that the whole movie is really obvious.
Yeah.
Although this has more resonance. It's a different thing, isn't it?
Well, it is a different thing. And I think the thing that the Sixth Sense does so beautifully is incorporate the supernatural into a mundane reality. You know, it's just everyday Philadelphia, just with dead people wandering around that only some characters can see. But Seven is, however gorgeous and aestheticized and distinctive, it's supposed to be the real world.
Yeah.
And John Doe is just a lunatic. He's very smart and he's very resourceful. But there's nothing in it that can't happen, which is the most distressing thing.
Yeah, there's nothing consoling about it.
Yeah.
At all. Like, Sixth Sense is consoling, ultimately.
Sure, there's a happy ending. You know. Ultimately, he learns how to use his gift, which is the story all ghost stories end up telling now, which is fine, but we've seen it. Seven, I mean, we've also seen movies like Seven where the killer gets away with it or triumphs morally, but this is, the whole film is just designed to press itself down on you until you can't breathe. Mm-hmm. And going through it the second time, I didn't have the advantage of this. I knew who John Doe would be because of the stupid press kit incident. But somebody told me afterwards, who hadn't seen it at a press screening and just wandered in and said, I, you know, In the last act, if it had turned out that it was Morgan Freeman all along, I would have been okay with it. That he would have bought it because of the defeat and the idea that his foreshadowing could be interpreted as, and it's been me all along. Also because you never actually see any of the murders committed. He could be staging the tableau. And I thought, if it had been anyone other than Morgan Freeman playing that role, I could buy it. But I'm so glad it wasn't. I'm so glad that they played that straight. Because, again, it would be something where people would be talking about the twist, but the twist that they ended up with, the ending they went with, is so much more devastating than the good guy is the bad guy. Although that is what happens as well. A different good guy. But, you know, and the other ending that they had storyboarded, it was on the Criterion Laserdisc. I think it surfaced in storyboards on the DVD or Blu-ray as well, when the ending that has Somerset shoot Doe before Mills can and say, what are you doing? I'm retiring.
Yeah.
No. I think everybody knew that wouldn't work. And they just staged it for the storyboards as badly as they could so that the studio would go, yeah, you're right, head in the box. There's no other way.
It's an interesting notion because it's like he is then sacrificing himself to a degree. But I think that offers is too much of an easy route for the film.
Yeah.
You know, it would be too... It would be kind of... It would work, but I don't think it would satisfy. I thought it was interesting the first time I saw that. I was like, oh, okay, I wonder how... Maybe you'd feel slightly happier walking out. I don't know.
Yeah. It doesn't line up with the moral universe that's established. You think about Leland Orser as the victim of lust, the ultimate victim of lust, I suppose, who is so shattered and destroyed in that one scene that I think that brings home the trajectory of the film more effectively than anything else. Like, this is awful. And yes, it's a horrific depiction of violence against a woman who has no identity or agency and is just a body, but it was 1995, and that's kind of how people accepted that stuff as a film noir-ish representation.
Well, also, it's not like she's the only victim who doesn't have a life in the movie.
Exactly, that's the other thing that's sort of forgivable about it. It just, because of the nature of her murder, it is just so horrible. Watching it again, I was just like, oh, that's... Yeah, that's just someone indulging his worst self as a screenwriter, trying to figure out what the most horrible thing you can imagine is, and then that's where it led him. Because gluttony, it's...
Hey, we've all been there.
It's disturbing, but it's also completely preposterous. Yeah. You can disconnect on one level or another, and you can just think, oh, that's a cool... Like, that's like a Friday the 13th murder.
Yeah.
You know, like that's kind of neat. When you get to lust, there's no rationalization of it. It's just awful. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's effective. And Orser plays that, and there's no joking out of it. There's no attempt to shrug it off, even though, like, the other characters are just sort of silent when they're faced with it, and there's no processing of it other than, oh God, that's awful. And I think in that moment, you know, again, if you think John Doe has a point, this is the part where you have to keep watching and realize that, no, he doesn't. This is just cruelty. But, yeah, I mean, I remember seeing that and thinking, oh, okay, the movie is going to a place that most of these movies don't allow themselves to go to. I mean, even Manhunter 10 years ago hadn't, 9 years earlier, hadn't really depicted any of its horrors. They were all suggested and after the fact. But, you see Freddie Lowndes in his flaming wheelchair, but you don't actually watch the wounds inflicted on him. It just cuts to it. This movie is about the aftermath of depravity. And by going for it, this was a major studio release in 1995 when other people were making movies like Copycat or The Usual Suspects, which is a gorgeous and clever movie, but is not about this sort of ugliness. And I get it. Like, I get where it fits in Fincher's development too. After Alien 3, this was the way he could show people that he was commercial and viable, but also an artist. But still, like, to take that leap, and I'd love to talk to him about it someday, because I'm sure there are angles on it that I haven't even considered. That's just the kind of filmmaker he is.
Because I've spent a lot of time with him on set and interviewed him a bunch, but I've never actually really spoken to him about this film. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know why that is. Probably just because I got to know him after, like, around the time of Zodiac. Oh, that's an interesting kind of companion piece.
Yeah.
In a way. I mean, one of the reasons that movie got made, I think, is because people were kind of going, I know it's like a 160-page script where they don't catch the killer, but it could be 7-2.
Yeah.
You know?
What if this is 77?
Yeah. But I think, you know, he said about Alien 3, you know, that his lesson from Alien 3 was take all the responsibility because you're going to get all of the blame. And that, which is why I think that film was so important, as much as he, you know, it sounds like he had an absolutely hideous time making it. It's like, well, if you go from being a really successful music video director and commercials director and then go and make a really successful movie, that's great, but you probably become insufferable, you know.
Yeah.
But if you go and then basically get your ass handed to you and get ripped apart, I wonder if that does you good in the longer term, you know, to go, oh, okay, well, I'm not going to, there are certain things I'll compromise on and there are certain things I won't. And I wonder whether someone who hadn't had that experience would have been able to make 7 and actually stick to his guns in the way that he did.
Yeah.
And just because I go, well, sod it, you know, I've got to just go for it. Because ultimately, any movie you make, it might be the last one you're going to make. So you think you've got to have the attitude of like, all right, I'm going to go for it. But it's very easy to compromise, just to settle.
Sure. Well, and the studio wants you to, because they're more concerned about return on investment, and the way you do that is through the path of least resistance, traditionally. I mean, that's why Transformers movie make $1 billion every 2 years without ever learning anything or ever being good. But yeah, Fincher, I mean, you look at his body of work, and while I really don't like Benjamin Button, I understand why he made it and what drew him to it. It's just, he makes movies that no one else should make, I think is the way I would put it now. Not because they're transgressive or distressing or that they shouldn't be made at all, but because he finds the perfect iteration of the material. Like, that Gone Girl adaptation is as good as the movie could be based on that book. The book's great, but it doesn't allow for a lot of leeway in the interpretation, and he just narrows into the story and mimics the structure and lets the actors carry it, and it's just, it's so good. It just fires along on all cylinders beginning to end, and you know, you hear about him destroying the actors with 90 takes and all that, but that's how you get those performances in that way, and I'll defend it, because at this point I'm pretty sure anybody who signs up to work with him knows what they're getting into.
Yeah, I think a lot of them enjoy it, genuinely. I mean, in terms of, I mean, there are some people who don't enjoy it, you know, for sure, but I think you want to act. It's like you want to direct. Like, you don't get to direct very much. As in terms of the act, that process of being on the floor and working with actors and that stuff, which is really fun. So much of directing is, can I get the money? Who am I going to cast? Who am I going to work with? And, you know, can this happen? Is this the right thing? And just, like, all the exhausting work of not making movies, even on the scale that I make stuff, which is small, short films as it stands, it's still, like, especially short films, because you can't make, because there's never any return on investment. You basically go, would you like to make a film? It's a bit like burning thousands of pounds. You know? So if you're on the floor with the actors, then why not? You know, granted, you don't want to be doing it to no end. You know, you don't want to be doing it to just kind of like, yeah, go again, because I can't think of anything else.
Yeah.
But that is not the experience of not the people I've spoken to, you know, of like Ben Affleck or Jonathan Groff or Mindhunter. It's like, it's quite specific.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise you'd never finish. It just, if you did that with every scene, with every setup, there would not be movies.
And you kind of look at it and go, I look at it and go, man, like, you know, I think Ruffalo said like 67 takes or whatever on his first scene. He was just like hoping that Fincher was walking over to fire him. You know? But there's a reason that pretty much everybody in a David Fincher film gives their career best work. You know, even people who've been terrific for years, like Michael Douglas, is terrific in The Game.
Mm.
You know, I think that's,
I forgot we did The Game. There's 4 films in the 90s and we've covered them all now.
You know, that's kind of, you know, well, if that happened a couple of times, you go, okay, well, you know, it's a coincidence. But if it happens consistently, you know, that's That's not an accident. It doesn't mean that everybody has to do it, you know, and obviously it doesn't mean that we'll all have the opportunity to have that much time, or not the opportunity, not given those opportunities, you take them, you know. But you have to have a certain determination and talent in order to be able to take them.
You have to be, I mean, I also think that to make a movie like Seven, you have to understand determination. You have to know how to evoke that momentum and that compulsion. I'm not suggesting he's a serial killer himself, but certainly, like, the obsessive nature of filmmakers, of course this would be a movie instead of a novel or a comic book. This has to be a cinematic experience. It's immersive, it's disturbing. Even the way that the rain just always falls at the same tempo. Like, he's worked with his sound engineers and his lighting guys to get us to understand that, even though it's never commented on at all. It's just an element that never goes away and makes you feel the pressure on these people. And the world is just a dark, ugly place with dark, ugly people. And maybe somebody does the right thing, and maybe the right thing is the wrong thing, and everything goes to hell because that was the plan all along. And just, like, it's a film that you can watch over and over again because you can see the traps being set and Mills and Somerset walking into them over and over again, and just, and not seeing, you know, not reading the signs and not understanding how things are about to go horribly wrong. It's a film about the end of the world as experienced by two people. And had the world ended, I think I would have also understood that.
Do you think your feelings about the movie would change if the ending was different in terms of the original cut that was first shown to test audiences? Mills shoots Doe, you know, gunshot, cut to black, and you just hear a couple more gunshots.
We assume he shot himself.
Or whether he shoots himself or whether he's just, you know, he's just filling Doe with bullets. But there's no other explanation. There's no sense. Because I don't know for myself. Well, I know, like, the coda was kind of, everyone was kind of, that was the compromise. Like, we'll do the coda with the Hemingway quote to kind of soften things a little bit. I don't think anyone really wanted to do it.
I love that quote.
But it makes, you know, that he's going to go back to work.
Yeah.
You know, so you do know that there is a sense of, in spite of all this, like, horror, he is going to press on.
Yeah, but that's what makes it tragic on every level, that he's ruined, that Doe has ruined Somerset's retirement as well, that he's forced him to continue to be. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's the story of the knight, right, who just can't put his sword down. Mm-hmm. And again, this is why I was so glad that it didn't turn out to have been Somerset's plan all along, which I know was never scripted or even an idea, but someone, once I heard that reading, it sort of contaminated me as the possibility. It was like, yeah, you could make that work. But no, it shouldn't be. He is untarnished. He's broken, but he's not destroyed. And so, yes, of course, Somerset has to keep fighting. And that's, you know, that's the enduring tragedy of all genre fiction, right? Of all noir, of all detectives. If they don't get killed, they're just going to go back to work. It's Buffy, right? You never stop fighting until the monsters get you. And yeah, I don't think Somerset would have been bored in retirement, but I think he would also probably have had a chance at finding a life for himself, and that's gone now too, because he's just watched this fresh young kid just be destroyed utterly. It's a gravity that
pulls
him.
There's any comfort, police don't last long in retirement, generally speaking. My dad's retired.
I don't know that is a comfort.
as in, like, he's gone back to work, he's probably going to last longer at work.
Oh, good.
You know? Because it's a vocation, isn't it? You know.
I'm just reading I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is Michelle McNamara's book, the late Michelle McNamara's book, about finding a serial killer in California operating in the 70s and 80s. And she just talks about how all the police detectives who ran the cases, his murders and sexual assaults, are now older and retired, and she counts them as her friends because they're still working the case with her. They just can't stop. And the one good thing about it is that her book probably got the guy caught in the end. That she definitely exposed him, and it probably led to his arrest. But almost certainly. But yeah, the nature of the job is just to destroy the person who does it. I mean, that's the mythology of it, right? That's how we've built it up. Worse than first responders, they experience trauma, but they get to save people. The detectives, homicide detectives, are never saving anybody. They're just saving the next victims.
Well, there's always somebody who gets away. Yeah. So yeah. I think it must grind you down, especially if you don't... Well, I don't know how Well, that's why there's so much fiction about alcoholic detectives, isn't there?
Yeah.
Have you read The Force, Don Winslow's book?
No.
About police in New York? That is sensational. I think Jim Mangold's making a film of it.
But I'd
highly, highly recommend that. I mean, he's the lead in that is a kind of corrupt cop, but the point is, like, well, he's corrupt, but he has his rules, you know, and that's kind of...
There's that classic man with a code thing.
Yeah, and it works. It really works. You're like, okay, you know, it's interesting. You can sit back in an armchair quarterback at all, but actually there's a guy on the front line. What is he doing? You know, how do you deal with that stuff?
Mm-hmm. I think it's good that we don't get to know too much about Somerset, really, other than his upright moral presence. We don't know anything about what he likes. He complains about pizza. He's a monster. That's... The possibilities of... I mean, there's a version of this movie, like there's a version of every noir thriller where we get to find out he, you know, raises birds on a rooftop or something. Mm. We know more about Mill's life just because we go home with him. Somerset just does this, as far as I can tell. It's what makes Morgan Freeman perfect for it, because he can inhabit that and fill it out in the corners with just eye movements and a shrug. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I don't think there is any point in him retiring, really. This is his life. This is what he wants. I think, in a weird way.
Well, we know that he endures, you know, and he did have somebody, and he doesn't anymore.
Yeah.
Presumably because of the job, but, yeah, it's not more complicated than that. You just press on.
Yeah.
Press on in the face of all the darkness.
Yeah. It's such an uplifting movie.
But that's one of the things I like about, another thing I like about Zodiac as well, which is like jumping forward, mm-hmm. but like that's a movie where you go, that's really a movie about information as much as anything else, and like the movement of information and the sort of bureaucracy of law enforcement. And that's a film, I don't think my dad's ever seen Seven. I think I have probably advised him against it. But he saw Zodiac. We went and saw Zodiac, and he, you know, obviously he's a British policeman, but he came and go, that's the best film I've ever seen about police work, because mm-hmm. that's the reality of police work, is it's, you know, you don't...
Endless and unrelenting and inconclusive.
Yeah, you're not, like, it's not glamorous. You know, it's just kind of, yeah, a grind, and just pushing the ball forward an inch at a time, you know, mm-hmm. trying to get there. Which, well, I mean, the difference between the two movies might be why Seven made, like, $300 million worldwide and Zodiac made a tenner, but, yeah. Like, you know...
Possibly. People like an ending, even if it's a downbeat, horrible one.
Well, that's the best cop movie of the 90s and the best cop movie of the noughties.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing that he can make those films so rhyme together so well, because they are incredibly different otherwise, but they do feel like... I mean, there's clearly one intelligence behind both movies.
Yeah.
Oh, now I just want to watch Zodiac again, right?
Yeah, me too.
Well, to talk about influences then, I suppose, is there anything... your short films are not necessarily Finchery, but is there anything of Seven that has made it into your toolbox? Anything you've absorbed or stolen or put into your creative DNA?
I mean, probably unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
Not explicitly, you know, as in nothing I've explicitly gone, I'll have that. I think Bricks, the first short I made, is probably the most planned as a film, and actually the most sort of visually cohesive in a way because of that. And I was watching Seven this morning and thought, oh yeah, you have subconsciously tried to ape some of this stuff. How well or not, you know, I guess we'll have to find out by going looking on Vimeo. But I mean, that film has a sense of humour, I hope, even though it's kind of this little dark story, it has a sense of humour. You know, who knows what else has influenced the stuff that I've done. You don't know, you kind of look back and go, well, why have I made these films? And it's probably because of, yeah, stuff that's gone on in your own life, and then the stuff that influenced you a lot when you grew up, you know, which... So, Polanski films, Fincher, Cronenberg,
mm-hmm.
Ken Loach, Soderbergh, and
these are all my favourite directors too.
And you go, oh, okay, well, you know, not that you're deliberately going, oh, I'm going to try and make a Woody Allen movie, or I'm going to try and make a Ken Loach movie, or a David Fincher movie. I mean, the thing about Fincher is, as much as he's somebody who I do know and will ask for advice, I'm also, you know, setting yourself up to compare yourself or any of your work to like one of the greatest filmmakers of all time is a fool's game.
Yeah.
And accepting, like, you know, even if I had that kind of level of technical knowledge, like, you're just going to follow your own path. You kind of think you might be able to go, oh, I'm going to try and do this and try and control it, but ultimately you don't know anything that's going to grab you about a project and the things that, you know, so it feels like a little pretentious to compare the point, because I've made short films, I'm going to make feature films, but obviously I'm nowhere near his level. But I used to think, oh yeah, well, I'm going to do this film, and then I'm going to do that film, and then I'm going to do this film, and I'm going to try and do this. And now I realise that there's too many other factors. So all you know is you've got to make the film that you fall in love with at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that you fall in love with enough to know you're going to stick through it, even though there are going to be times where you hate it. and that's been the case with each of the shorts. It's like, you go, okay. Because they may be short films, in some ways I think they're harder to make. Well, I'll find out when I make a feature, whether they're harder to make in a feature, but like... because there's no return on investment, because it's, you have very, very little time and very little money, and the only person that's pushing you to make it is yourself, you know.
Mm.
So, you know, one else is going, yeah, please stop doing the stuff that earns money and go and make the thing that will hemorrhage cash. Do that. so you just try and make what's, yeah, just follow your nose, try and make what's inside yourself, and then you watch stuff because you think, well, that's how you get fed. Right. You know, that sounds a bit pretentious as well, but like, if you're burnt out or if you're struggling, you just kind of go, oh, look at you. I will refill by rewatching certain things. And watching stuff in a that wouldn't necessarily, people wouldn't necessarily see the correlation between them. I've written a sort of, or co-written a thriller, a feature thriller, which I will make, which is about a kind of man on holiday whose child goes missing, and the only guy to help him find his child is this other dad who's fallen out with really badly, and it's kind of this class war, straw dogsy kind of story.
Mm.
But actually the film I watch when I want to reinvigorate myself in relation to that is Black Swan. Very okay. different, because yeah. it's about somebody losing themselves and losing their sense of reality and kind of descending into some kind of madness through panic. So that's, there's no way I'm going to go, oh, watch Package, it's just like Black Swan. No one else is going to watch that movie and go, oh yeah, you know who could have played that really well? Natalie Portman. but you don't necessarily know where your inspiration will come from. And yeah, it just all becomes fuel. I'd love to say I was somebody who like gets it from literature and art, and occasionally, like, you know, I will try and make an effort to kind of, I must look in this gallery, or more often than not, to look on Google Images. But I'm not particularly cultured or particularly well-read. Movies are the thing, you know. And every once in a while, you stumble across something where you feel like you've got a specific and interesting point of view and thing to provide, and you hope, obviously, that enough other people feel the same way when they watch it.
Yeah. Or you could just make a serial killer movie. I mean,
well,
that's where the money is.
I hear there was a sequel script for Seven at some point.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know how true this was.
What would be the point?
But it was with Somerset as a psychic.
Oh, God. No.
So, you know, guys, I am available.
Oh, if Fincher knows you personally, then the best thing he can do is tell you to stop. Like, just, I would almost, you know, you can take the gig just so you get the email from him.
Yeah, no, it's not something that's ever likely to happen, unfortunately.
A psychic. Why would you do that?
I don't know what happened to that. I remember it.
Well, we hope it was set on fire.
Yeah, I'm sure it was burned in a dumpster. I think, well, he's got a veto on anything like that, I believe. So.
Oh, good.
You don't need to worry about it.
See, the universe has a moral balance after all.
Yeah, despite all the hideousness, you keep on and good things will happen.
My thanks to Neville Pierce, whose new short film Promise is available to watch on Vimeo right now under The Pitch. We'll provide a link to it on the site. You'll be able to find it pretty easily. You can also find Nev's other shorts, Bricks, Lock-In, and Ghosted, the last one starring friend of the show Alice Lowe, at vimeo.com/Neville Pierce. Thanks also to Audrey Ewell and Paul Atherley. They know what they did. You can follow Nev on Twitter at Nev Pierce, all one word, and you can find Seven on Blu-ray and DVD from Warner Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.